Hello and welcome to Pythagorean Astronomy. I'm Chris North, and what you're about to listen to was originally broadcast as part of Pythagoras' Trousers, a science and engineering show on Radio Cardiff. You can find a full show and listen to past episodes at pythagorastrousers.co.uk. But for now, here's this month's astronomy. Well, what an exciting month March has been, astronomically speaking. We had stargazing live on the telly, and then on the 20th of March, that solar eclipse. Although the total solar eclipse was only visible from the North Atlantic, the Faroe Islands and Svalbard, from the UK we were treated to a partial eclipse of the sun, with part of the disk of our star obscured by the moon. From Cardiff we had wonderful weather. We had over 1,000 people on the steps of the National Museum, all enjoying the solar eclipse, with eclipse glasses, with pinhole cameras, and even with a simple colander. It was great fun. Now, solar eclipses aren't just a pretty sight. They can also tell us about the very nature of our universe. To explore more about this, I spoke to Dr. Mark Hannam here in Cardiff University. Our story begins in what might seem an unexpected place, with Sir Isaac Newton and our understanding of gravity a few hundred years ago. I began by asking Mark what Isaac Newton had taught us about the nature of gravity.
So the idea that we currently have of gravity, or that most people have, which is that it's the force that holds us down on the ground and what makes things that we let go of fall to the ground, this originally comes from Newton. It was Newton who understood gravity as a force, and really it was Newton who made clear the very concept of a force. Gravity, as something that makes us stick to the ground, was of course known of long before Newton. People couldn't fail to notice that when they tripped, they fell down. What was amazing about what Newton did was that he realized that the force that holds us on the ground is exactly the same force that sends the Earth around the Sun and the Moon around the Earth. What was really impressive about it was that Newton formulated his law of gravity in essentially one equation, which will predict for you, if you put in the masses and positions and motions of objects, it will predict for you how things move according to gravity. And so with that formula, he could predict how things fall on the Earth. He could predict where you should fire a cannonball if you want to hit your enemy. And with exactly the same formula, he could predict how the Earth moves around the Sun, how the Moon goes around the Earth, and how the effect of the Moon's gravitational field affects the tides on the Earth. All of these can be predicted with one formula. And so this was really an incredible achievement, and really was the beginning of the scientific revolution, and the notion of using mathematics and using experiment to understand nature. And over the course of the next couple of hundred years, Newton's law was tested in more and more detail, and more subtle effects of, in particular, of planetary motion were calculated and were tested against the theory, and time again, it was correct.
And it even goes as far as when we send spacecraft through the solar system, we use Newton's law of gravity, right? I mean, that works very well for sending spacecraft to Jupiter and Saturn and so on.
That's right. It's really an incredible theory, and incredibly successful. And it should be said, of course, in terms of eclipses, the reason that we knew when this eclipse was going to happen, and not just to the day, but it was known to the exact second when the eclipse was going to happen and precisely where was the best place to observe it. And that was known not just a few months before. That was predicted years before. And we know of all of the eclipses that are going to happen into the foreseeable future, and we know of that, and we can predict that because of Newton's theory.
So Newton's law of gravity tells us how masses interact. So two objects, a planet and a star, or a person and a planet falling towards the planet or whatever, how they interact and how fast they'll move and how hard they'll hit and all these kind of things. But there's one other thing, which was how light interacts with these matter, and that took a revolution at the start of the 20th century.
Newton's theory, as it was originally formulated, did describe how light would move, and he had a particle view of light. And with that theory, one of the things that you expect to happen is that you would expect that light going past the sun would be deflected on its path, and so it would change the direction it goes in and be deflected. And this is a very, very small effect, but it was actually Einstein who calculated the size of this effect for light going around the sun and proposed an experiment to observe it, which was that if you had some distant star which you could normally see in the sky, if the sun was now between the earth and the star, then of course you would not be able to see it. But if the light from the star were to bend around the sun, then we might again be able to see that star. And so by observing stars which should be obscured by the sun, we could measure this deflection and we could see if this is really agreed with what Newton predicted, or what prediction came from Newton's theory.
Of course, normally that's very difficult, because when the sun's in the sky, it's rather difficult to see stars. But this is where the eclipse came in useful.
Exactly. So that's the trick, is that when the moon is in front of the sun, you can't see the sun. And now you can, in principle, with sufficiently sensitive equipment, you can now observe the stars again. And so then you could hope to see any stars that might be behind the sun, but have their light bent around it and come to Earth. And so that was the suggested experiment.
That was back in 1911, and the plans started to move forward, and then a little something called the First World War got in the way of all these plans. And in the meantime, Einstein did some more work on the theory behind it.
One of the problems with Newton's theory, and it was a problem that people realized right from the very beginning, was that there's no explanation in there of what gravity is, of where this force comes from and how it works. And it seemed incredible to, what seemed impossible to people, that there could be some magical, invisible force that reaches out from the sun across millions and millions of miles of space and pulls the Earth around the sun with it. And that was the main objection to Newton's theory when he proposed it. And of course, the counter-argument to that was that the theory worked. And over time, this objection faded away because the theory was so phenomenally successful. But Einstein came back to this objection, and he found a way around it. He found a way of explaining gravity without a force.
And to do without a force involves not inventing new forces, but changing our understanding of the fabric of the universe itself.
Yeah, so the really amazing idea that Einstein had, a really radical idea, which even sounds crazy and radical today, was to suggest that space and time are stretched by a gravitational field, by the presence of a massive object. And what this means is, and you might think, well, space is just empty, there's nothing there, how can you stretch nothingness? But it's clearly not the nothingness it's stretched. What's happening is that the presence of a massive object is actually changing the distance between objects. And so the distance from the Earth to the Sun, if you replace the Earth and the Sun with peanuts, and you looked at the direction, the distance between those two peanuts, that would actually be less than it is with the Sun and the Earth there. The presence of these massive objects is stretching distances and changing the geometry. So Einstein's suggestion was that the actual geometry of the universe was changed by massive objects. The usual explanation of the force of gravity in terms of this geometry, as you say, is with these rubber sheets or some object sitting in the middle of a trampoline or whatever. And I always find this a bit of a strange explanation, because really you're using gravity to explain gravity.
Yeah.
But a different picture that I like to use is just to get across the idea that changing the geometry of space might actually cause something that looks like a force, is if you think about what happens if you're on Earth, where everything should be normal and sane, and if you take two people to the equator, say to somewhere in Africa, and you put them hundreds of miles apart and you ask them to walk directly north, and if they have very good equipment and they're hardy individuals, they may walk directly north, and they will think that they're going in parallel, and that parallel lines never meet, and so they will think that they're never going to meet each other. But we know that, in fact, they will meet at the North Pole. And we understand that because the Earth is curved. The Earth is a ball. And so if two people move in perfectly straight lines directly north, they will meet. But if those people were to look at if they were to believe that the Earth was actually flat, if they were flat Earthers, and they looked at their motion or the path that they took on a flat map, it would seem that their paths were curved. And the only conclusion that they would come to, because they were really dedicated flat earthers, would be that there was some mysterious invisible force acting on them. And I think that's a way that you can see that some curved geometry can trick you into thinking that there's really a force there. And of course, it's very difficult for us to imagine that, that space and time are curved, and we certainly can't see this curvature. And so when we see objects going, Earth going around the sun, it's quite natural for us, and it was quite natural for Newton to interpret this as a force. But in reality, there's not some mysterious force acting there, it's just that there's this curvature.
This curvature changed some of the subtle predictions that the theories of gravity make about what happens to light as well, and that affected the predictions that Einstein had made for these experiments involving eclipses.
Most of the predictions that come from Einstein's theory really have a extremely small difference to the predictions from Newton's theory, and it's usually very, very difficult to tell the two theories apart. But one of the areas where there is a significant difference is in this effect of the deflection of light around the sun. And in fact, in this case, the deflection that's predicted from Einstein's theory from curved space is twice that from Newton's theory. So it's not just a slight incremental modification, it's actually it's a factor of two. It doubles the effect. And so it should be very clear whether, in this case, whether Newton's theory is correct or whether Einstein's theory is correct. The problem, of course, is that the deflection is still extremely small. It's less than a thousandth of a degree of deflection. So it's a very subtle effect to measure. But that was the test that was proposed. And for the solar eclipse in 1919, an expedition set out to in fact measure it.
And so that was Arthur Eddington, a British astronomer, and Frank Dyson set off in 1919 to go and measure the eclipse. They travelled down towards the equator where the eclipse was best seen and tried to take some of these really difficult measurements. And they got lucky in the end.
There were two expeditions, one to Brazil and one to this island of Principe. And in Brazil they had very good weather and they took a large number of high-quality photographs. In Principe, they had rain for the days leading up to the eclipse, and even on the day of the eclipse, there was heavy cloud. And this eclipse was expected to be, I think, about 4 minutes and 50 seconds long. So it's quite a long eclipse. And for 4 minutes and 40 seconds, there was cloud. It was not possible to take any pictures. And in the last 10 seconds, much like in a movie, the clouds opened and it was possible to take one very good photograph. So Eddington returned to Britain with his one good photograph from Principe, and then there were a number of photographs from Brazil, and these were analysed over the next months. And the conclusion came out that there really was a deflection of light, which was a relief for everyone, and also that the deflection was in agreement with Einstein's theory. Now, there was a very subtle experiment. It was difficult to get very accurate measurements, and there was some uncertainty in the numbers, and there was some debate as to whether or not this could be claimed as clinching evidence for Einstein's theory. But all of the astronomers who looked at the data and performed a very careful analysis, they concluded that, yes, indeed, the results were in agreement with Einstein.
And one of the big effects was this, was it propelled Einstein to international stardom.
Before this event, Einstein was unknown outside the scientific world. He'd discovered special relativity in 1905, which was 14 years earlier, and he was a renowned physicist, but he was unknown to the general public. But after this event, really this notion that geometry is the most basic geometry that we understand, that we learn about in school, is changed by his theory, really caught the public imagination. And after that, he was a science superstar, and he is still today the most recognizable icon, image of science.
I think the hair has something to do with it.
At the time of the in 1919, his hair was quite tame, but with fame, he got more and more wild.
Yeah. I mean, jumping forward to the present day, I mean, the eclipse of 1919, that expedition validated Einstein's theories and led him to this stardom and proved that general relativity was indeed or did indeed seem to be a correct explanation for what gravity is and what it does. But even today, you're still looking to test this theory in new ways. So what are you working on today to test these theories of gravity?
So today, there have been a number of tests of Einstein's theory since it was proposed, and it's passed all of them. And in a way, it's much like with Newton's theory, that Newton's theory made some predictions, and people, after the theory was published, produced more and more elaborate and precise calculations of what the theory would predict, and then those were tested, and they were confirmed, at least up until Einstein came along. And now the same thing is happening with Einstein's theory. More and more precise predictions are being made, and they are being tested. And there are still a few effects left to test, and one of them, which is one of the effects that, people here in Cardiff and around the world are trying to verify, is the effect of gravitational waves. And so this was one of the key predictions from Einstein's theory, was that the effect of gravity sends ripples through space and time, ripples in this geometry, tiny fluctuations in these distances between objects, which move out through the universe at the speed of light. And experiments have been set up all around the world to try and observe these effects. They're extremely small. If you think that the deflection of light around the sun is small, this is a far smaller effect. This causes changes in the lengths of objects in these experiments, which are on the order of the size of atoms. So these are very small effects, but equipment has been built that's up to the task, and actually later this year these experiments will be switched back on again, and we hope in the next few years to actually finally measure directly these last key predictions from Einstein's theory.
And these experiments you talk of, the LIGO is one of them, the two LIGO mm-hmm. detectors, or advanced LIGO as they're going to be called later this year when they turn on. So these use the distances travelled by laser beams to measure the stretching and compression of space. You said that gravity causes these ripples. What kind of things cause ripples? Are there specific objects you're looking for?
So as I said before, the effects of this of gravitational waves are is very small. They're very, very weak. So the only way that we can have any hope whatsoever of detecting them is to find the strongest possible signals of the waves. And the strongest signals that we can think of, or the strongest sources we can think of, are very violent astrophysical events, like two black holes or two neutron stars spiraling in and colliding with each other. And these are the events in the universe that we're hoping to observe. Not only would detecting these gravitational waves confirm this prediction of Einstein's theory, but they would also give us unprecedented information about those sources. So in particular for black holes, which by their very nature cannot be seen, these are objects which we can learn a lot about from the gravitational wave signals, and these can tell us how many black holes there are out there in the universe, how massive they are, how fast they spin, and this in turn can give us information about how they form. And this can also then tell us about how galaxies form and how the universe has evolved. And so there's a huge wealth of information that we can hope to glean from these gravitational waves, in addition to giving Einstein another thing that he was right about.
So it really is opening a new window on the way we can do astronomy, and a completely new way of looking at the universe.
Yes, the way that a lot of people think about gravitational waves is actually like sound, is like sound recording, because the frequencies of the gravitational waves that our detectors will be sensitive to are very close to the audio frequencies that we're used to. And so in some sense we're turning on a microphone to the universe. And so you could think of conventional astronomy, or all the various advances in astronomy over the last few centuries, as taking deeper and clearer photographs of the universe. And what gravitational waves will allow us to do really will be to turn on the microphone and hear the soundtrack.
And as you say, later this year the upgraded experiments will turn on, and then fingers crossed within the next few years. I mean, I guess it's probably a bit harsh of you to ask you to put a date on when these are going to be found, but I'll do it anyway.
I'm probably contractually obliged not to put a date on this. Because gravitational waves are so weak, and because their sources, a number of sources are difficult to see by any other means, we have very poor knowledge of how many of these events there are out there in the universe. So it could be that within the first year or so of the detectors being switched on, we see a couple of events, but it could also take 5 years to see something. In the first case, where we see some in the first few years, then 5 years later, when our detectors reach their maximum design sensitivity, where all of the extra experimental tricks that are going to be pulled, when all of those are in place, then we may be seeing hundreds of these events per year, but we may also be seeing just one or two. You could think of this negatively, that, well, maybe we're going to wait a very long time, and maybe we won't see them with these detectors, and maybe we'll have to wait even longer. But the other way I think of looking at this is that we're very confident that these events are out there. We know gravitational waves exist. We have indirect evidence for them. And so really it's not a question of whether we will detect them, it's just a question of when. And so sometime over the next 5 or so years, one day someone will announce that the signal's there in the detector and everything's going to change.
And things will change almost as much as they did back at the start of the 20th century with Einstein's theory. So, Mark Hanna, thanks very much.
Thank you.
So, solar eclipses, not just a pretty sight to look at, also of scientific value. Although solar eclipses occur somewhere in the world at least twice a year, we see them from the UK much more rarely than that. In fact, the next good partial solar eclipse visible from the UK isn't until 2026, that's 11 years away, and the next total eclipse isn't visible from the UK until 2090. To see them before then, you have to travel around the world. So the Pacific Ocean next year, or the continental United States in the summer of 2017. So start planning those summer holidays. You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North. It was originally broadcast on Radio Cardiff as part of Pythagoras' Trousers.